This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
This
is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
I'm Nora Young, and on this Spark, we're sparking a revolution. It's time to get our hands dirty, from the future of the web to the return of DIY. Don't be a slave to your technologies. You have nothing to lose but your digital chains. Our first look at the future of hands-on doesn't start in a lab or online, but on a pier in New England. A couple of years ago, Matthew Seiler was living in Portland, Maine. He just graduated from the Landing School,
which is a small school that teaches traditional wooden boat building in Kennebunkport, Maine.
So he's fresh out of school, and he's building these wooden boats.
Right downtown Portland, and one of my best friends, he ended up opening up a pizza restaurant just a couple wharfs down. He ended up hiring me as a waiter to kind of make ends meet. You know, in between building boats during the day, I'd go and wait tables at night.
Matthew would serve pizza and soda, pizza and soda, pizza, soda, pizza, soda.
Just serve so many sodas, crappy tasting, bad for you concoctions to my customers to accompany all this great organic, all natural food. I just was fed up with it.
Matthew figured he could do better. So he started brewing all by himself.
Started making sodas and testing them out on the staff, and ended up coming up with a recipe that was good enough that we started serving at the restaurant.
And then the sodas were picked up by a distributor, and they started being sold in more restaurants. Now, Matthew and his brother run their own beverage company called Main Root, all because Matthew wasn't satisfied with what was available off the shelf.
The people are kind of sick of being handed something prepackaged. People want to know where it comes from, what the roots are, you know, especially with food. They want to know where the ingredients are grown and how they're processed and how they're manufactured, and that means a lot.
Over the last generation or so, most of us got hooked on off-the-shelf goods. You know, cheap, easily replaced electronics, clothes, toys, root beer. Custom-made objects were pretty much just for the rich. But what's coming back with a vengeance is custom-made for the rest of us. Custom-made because you make it yourself. Maybe the future of tech isn't so much about the labor-saving device we were always promised, as it is about having the time to love the free labor that we do. Matthew Seiler and his DIY Pop are just one of the participants in this weekend's Maker Fair in Austin, Texas.
It's a family event. It's 2 days, and we've actually taken the old county fair and reprogrammed it with things that we like to do today. So it could be, if you're into rockets, it could be making rockets. If you're into crafting, it's for people that are open to meeting people that are making kind of crazy things, either in their garage or at their home or with their friends.
Maker Faire is this massive event that brings together tinkerers and DIYers from all over a couple of times a year. It's organized by the do-it-yourself Bible, Make Magazine.
My name is Sherry Huss, and I'm focused on creating and producing Maker Faires across the world.
Now the DIY trend is huge. There are countless television shows, thousands of websites, including yours, a very popular Make.
Yes.
Why do you think DIY has taken off recently?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a renaissance. I think it's always been there, but I think with kind of the kind of a newer generation getting involved, and maybe in their normal work world in the days of computers these days, with, you know, how many emails and email accounts to check and cell phones and messages to get back to, the joy of making and actually physically having an object and working on something and sharing that, I think is just sort of the counterbalance to kind of the craziness of the tech world that we all live in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things about, you know, makers is that it might include people who are doing fairly low-tech things or older tech, but also people who might have sophisticated engineering backgrounds, for instance. What connects those people with wanting to really, you know, muck around in the basement on the weekends?
As they're progressing in their career, the realities are is that at a certain point at work, they're managing people and projects.
Mm-hmm.
They're really not making things at work, which is sort of why they got into engineering. However, the flip side of that is that when you get them when you get them at home, when you get them out with their friends, you really start finding that they're making a lot of cool things.
Mm-hmm. You know, my neighbor spends every Sunday afternoon in the garage with the garage door open out onto the lane. And he's working on his car. He's fixing things. But he's fairly unusual, at least in my neighborhood. How does the way our homes are laid out reflect how we're spending our spare time these days?
Well, that's interesting. Actually, we have one of our contributors, Mr. Jalopy, who's based down in L.A., who's actually on the cover of the current Volume 11 of Make. For the past 20 years, has been checking out garage sales, just, you know, in the pursuit of looking for objects and tools. And he told me he's been chronicling kind of the death of the workbench in the garage.
Hmm.
So garages, which traditionally had been a place for actually either having a great workbench and tools, it actually has been replaced with storage bins. Again, because we have way too much of things that we're not using. But the great thing about makers is that their spirit and actually kind of getting involved in setting up their own workbench is actually quite great.
You know, Sherry, it all sounds like a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, isn't it cheaper and easier and maybe even better quality to, you know, I don't know, buy a bicycle instead of making it?
I don't know. You know, I actually think that once you meet the people and you find out that, hey, you can customize your bicycle this way, because it says something about you.
Yeah.
I do believe that the objects and the physical parts are really key. And especially since I think a lot of that even is not being taught in schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So home ec is gone. Industrial arts is gone. So where do they get, you know, where do you get to actually learn how to put something together or how to, pick up a tool and understand what it's used for? So this is really giving people and of all ages permission to play.
Sherry, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Maker Faire and the DIY spirit it embraces is one way of reclaiming what's real and hands-on at a time when so much of our world is going virtual. But the funny thing is, when we look ahead at the future of the internet, it's not so much that the virtual is taking over, but that the line between what's real and what's virtual is starting to get kind of blurry. Let's take tourism, for example. Say you want to go to, I don't know, the Grand Canyon with your sister, but your schedules don't match. What if you could meet in a totally realistic-looking virtual Grand Canyon
virtual
online?
Grand Canyon virtual online.
You have a little avatar, a cartoon version of yourself.
Hi.
And so does your sister.
Hello.
The two cartoons wander together. You can actually talk to each other, hang out, and check out the canyon.
Hello!
Maybe that's the next best thing to being there. I know it sounds crazy and everything, but it's just one vision of the future of the internet.
My name is Jamais Cachot.
Jamais is a futurist.
Futurist, blogger, writer, thinker.
Who's thought a lot about the future of the internet. People like him call it the metaverse.
There are a couple of different possibilities as to what's next. It really depends on what kind of world you want to live in. We could work on continuing to build out the accuracy and detail of the Google Earth flying through the Grand Canyon to make it as absolutely realistic as possible, where you look around and you see other people who are visiting the Grand Canyon along with you. We could change things and make it so that we have embedded sensors and information systems around the Grand Canyon so that when you visit it in person, actually you have at your fingertips the full range of information resources that would otherwise require you to be sitting at your computer.
So there are two sides to the future of the internet. In one, you remain in a virtual online world, but it looks increasingly like an exact copy of the world around us, like that Grand Canyon example where you're hanging out with your sister.
Hello.
In another, the kind of information that we used to look up at a website will now be found all over the real world. We're going to explore both scenarios over the next two episodes of Spark, but today, the smart environment. It sounds like sci-fi, but consider this. Say you're thinking of buying a home. One day, you're out for a walk and you see it. Cutest house ever. Now, before you fall totally in love with it and take out a second mortgage on your children, can you even afford it? So you whip out your cell phone, point it at the building. It finds out how much the house sold for last, and up pops the information immediately. Fantastic! It sounds like the future, but some cell phone customers in the U.S. are already doing this. All they need is software called Smarter Agent, a cell phone equipped with GPS navigation technology, which is pretty common now, and wireless internet access. All Smarter Agent does is connect information in online databases, real estate prices, with a particular location, which is what the GPS unit tells us. Now, if that's available now, what will that technology look like in 5 years?
I like to think of it as a smart environment because it gives us an opportunity to make visible the information that's already out there, make it easily accessible. You know, floating in the, you know, perhaps if you have a special pair of glasses floating off on the side of your view, a little note indicating that what interesting thing happened at this exact location 75 years ago or 175 years ago. You know, imagine every geographic location having its own version of Wikipedia, with information contributed by visitors explaining what's going on here.
This model of the internet goes by a couple of terms, and unless I miss my guess, we're going to start hearing a lot more about it in the next year or so. It often gets called blended reality, augmented reality, or the Internet of Things. It sounds like futurology, but as science fiction author William Gibson said, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet. William Gibson told me he doesn't like the term
blended reality, but that's like such a bad buzzword, right? It's like the opposite of cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
Like you hear it and you just go, no, I don't want it. it's like it's very beige,
like
right?
A blended fiber or something.
Yeah, it sounds very beige and no one wants a beige buzzword.
So what does it mean for the way we'll be living our lives if the internet is everywhere? We can already glimpse where it's headed, like Gibson does in his new book, Spook Country.
Cyberspace is, as one of the characters in the book says, busily turning itself inside out.
Yeah.
It used to be that we were here and cyberspace was there, except when we were in cyberspace, which wasn't very much. Now I think something has happened in the meantime that cyberspace is here. And we're here in cyberspace, except for those increasingly rare times when we're not. And those times when your cell phone won't work, you can't check your email, those have become, for a lot of people, that's the minority of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something's happened. And cell phones aren't just cell phones anymore. Your laptop is a cell phone, if you enable it. So when a telephone's not a telephone anymore, suddenly the whole world is connected in this big, strange way.
If the future of the internet is that the everyday world around us is annotated with additional information, who gets to say what information you'll be looking at?
You know that there's going to be spam. That's the sort of the inevitable side effect,
right?
Which means there will be spam filters. Not all of the filters will be simply to avoid make money fast advertisements. There will be filters that will help to block out things that you wouldn't want your children to see, things that might offend your sensibilities,
mm-hmm.
things that might make you angry. Maybe even filter out the presence of someone that you don't like. I mean, imagine that, walking down the street and seeing most of the people there, but some people are just sort of blanked out because they're the wrong political party, the wrong religion,
right.
Or somebody who bothered you when you were in elementary school.
Uh-huh. But what becomes of the real world? You know, the regular old real world without all the digital sticky notes attached to it that you look at with special glasses or on your cell phone?
My hunch has always been that our grandchildren would find the question quaint, you know? I suspect that our grandchildren will find our idea that there is a real world, really quaint and sort of Victorian.
Hmm.
I think the idea that you those are two absolutely separate things is probably the result of our relatively clunky technology and the distinction between, you know, real world and virtual. It's not going to be very strong. I think it's going to be sort of abstract.
William, thank you very much for talking with me.
No, very good. Thank you.
If you want to find out more about augmented reality, we've got more info at the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. Next week, part two of The Future of the Internet, what happens when fantasy online landscapes like Second Life meet mirror copies of the real world, like Google Earth's satellite images. They call it the 3D web. Next week. We've been talking about how people are reclaiming the physical, you know, going DIY or pushing the internet out into the real world around us. But it's really not a universal trend. Like, take newspapers, for instance. That rolled-up newsprint that lands with a satisfying thunk at your doorstep every morning may be getting sucked into your computer. If newspaper staff are being laid off, ad revenue is shrinking, eyeballs are moving online,
will there be newspapers
when our grandkids are grown up? This is Catherine Rolfson. She's a master's student in journalism at UBC. Who better to host a look at the future of the newspaper than a future journalist?
Thanks, Nora. So here with me today to talk about the future of newspapers are Andrew Keen, and he's the author of the book The Cult of the Amateur. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
And also Rahaf Harfouch. And she's a writer and a researcher, and she's got an interest in citizen journalism. Hi, Rahaf.
Hi.
Okay, so I'm a journalism student, and this summer I did an internship at a newspaper, and I saw firsthand how a newsroom was trying to transition from print to an online product. Can you give me some examples of who's doing a good job and why?
Well, the newspaper I really like, which I rely on religiously, is the Guardian Unlimited. On the one hand, they maintain the authority of journalists by only allowing professional journalists to actually report the news. But on the other hand, they open up the online newspaper to comments from their users. Now, some of those comments, I think, are rather embarrassing and I think show the shallowness of much of user-generated content.
So, Rahaf, do you think that this is the kind of role that newspapers should be playing online, or do you think they should go further?
I think they should definitely go further. I mean, I go to a Google, you know, site that sort of shows me how 15 different newspapers presented that article and how bloggers are talking about it. And I click and I see videos and links and maps and graphics, and I see people who are in the neighborhood and people who are commenting on it. It's this, you know, very rich multimedia experience. You obviously aren't going to maybe place the same weight of opinion of a BBC reporter as, you know, I don't know, some random person in, like, Idaho. But I really think that, you know, maybe that person in Idaho has a really valid point. Maybe they were there. Maybe they took pictures. And I give some, you know, validation to that.
I would strongly disagree with that. I think that the challenge for newspapers actually is being more credible and authoritative in an age in which information is increasingly chaotic and anarchic. And I'm very encouraged, by the way, in which, say, newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, some of the London newspapers, are actually being forced to be more credible, more authoritative, and actually delving deeper and deeper into the news.
At the same time, though, I think there's something to be said about having a multitude of voices because, I mean, I don't necessarily trust if I just hear one story. It might be really in-depth, but that's still only one perspective. I think you need a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, I, again, strongly disagree with that. I think it's very, very dangerous for people like you to be suggesting that we shouldn't trust media. By creating that kind of skepticism, you're actually undermining the coherence of the reader and creating this sort of hall of mirrors in which no one can trust anything. And the more sources you go to, the more confused you are. And you certainly shouldn't rely on bloggers in Iowa. What do they know about anything?
But I also think that, I mean, not all blogs are equal. I think that within there are people who maybe are very credible and who are professionals who are, you know, who specialize in, you know, political theory or international relations or whatever it is, who are commenting. And sometimes I feel that their comments add a tremendous value to the issues that we are talking about today.
I think they do, although one of my problems with the blogosphere is that people believe that people are encouraged to give away their intellectual labor for free. And I want to see people rewarded for their work. It's a
I just
tiny
want to back it up for you guys.
Bloggers are actually being paid for their work.
For a second, I want to back it up to what we started out with, the shift of newspapers to online. I'm going to be graduating from a Master's of Journalism program within the year. What do you think my job's going to look like 10 years from now? Rahaf, do you want to start?
Sure. I think that actually it's going to be, we're going to rely on you a lot more. However, instead of just reporting the story, you know, I think you're going to have to also talk about the stuff that's happening on the web as well. And you bring them all together for me, you know, in a concise, well-written way. I think that would provide tremendous value.
I'm afraid I got rather bad news for you. In 10 years, the chances of you having a job, if things continue as they are actually low. You're more likely to be in PR, or you're a lot more likely to be building websites. The crisis in newspapers is very serious. Last year was, and this year, the worst years in terms of newspapers laying off journalists. So I think unless we figure out a way to more effectively monetize news online, and we figure out a way for people to actually pay for that news and respect professional journalists, the chances of you actually having a full-time job are relatively low.
Well, here's hoping. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Andrew.
Thank you. That was fun.
And thank you, Rahaf.
Absolutely.
You can find out more about the future of news. CBC News is hosting a panel called The Future of News about citizen journalism and the mainstream media on October the 17th. Rahaf and Andrew will be two of the participants, along with Leonard Brody. He's founder of the citizen journalism website Now Public. It'll be streamed live online at cbc.ca at 6 p.m. Eastern on the 17th. And if you're listening to this after that date, don't worry. There's a website where you can hear it and participate in the conversation about it. You can find a link at our blog, where it's cbc.ca/spark. Now, last time on Spark, we talked about the possibility of cell phones on airplanes, and the Spark community responded with a collective, "The horror, the horror."
There's no way you could be sane and still be in favor of cell phone use on planes.
Flying is already stressful for many, and a quiet and silent flight goes a long way in reducing the stress level.
I feel that this idea has obviously been proposed by an individual who does not spend much time on public transit.
Oh, by the way, I'm calling from a landline in a quiet office.
Next time on the show, it's Dude, Where's My Robot Made? We look at where are they now technologies, those great gadgets and services we were promised that just never materialized. Like, remember the paperless office, you know, with computers? Why would we need paper anymore? Well, we all know how that turned out. These are the papers on my desk alone. We'd like to hear your picks for technologies we were promised that just never materialized. Send us an email, spark@cbc.ca, or leave a comment at the blog.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you're listening to Spark. Tech, trends, and fresh ideas. cbc.ca/spark.
We were talking earlier in the show about how the internet of the future may be distributed in the environment instead of just on your computer, but there are already secret technologies all around us that you might not even know are there, and they're affecting the way you live every day.
1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000.
I'm not sure this is going to work, or if it does work, if we would know.
5-1000, 6-1000.
And then I didn't quite get the same magnet that we were supposed to get.
No, look, it's changing now. Okay, I should explain, actually. I'm at a traffic light with Tom Howell. He's normally our tech-a-cat expert. But today, we're trying to get the traffic light to change faster. So, I mean, we've all been there, right? You're in your car, the traffic light is red, you pull up, and then suddenly it seems to change as if by magic to green. And what's happening there is that there's a sensor that's detecting that your car is there. So that would work, except we're not in a car.
We're on our bicycles.
Yes, we're on our bicycles. And so we're too light to trip the light.
Can we play the phone call I had? Because it explains absolutely everything.
Yeah, Tom talked to somebody earlier.
His name is Kip Kay, and he is a guy in Florida, and he makes problem-solving videos that go on the internet. So that's where I found him.
Well, if you look down on the roads, a lot of times you'll see these squares or circles in the road at stoplights or turn signals. Well, that's what's called an inductive loop detector, and what that does is it just senses a large amount of metal like a car would have or a truck. But a lot of times motorcycles, scooters, bicycles, they just don't have enough metal to trigger these to cause a change in what's called the conductance of this loop. So you'll end up getting stuck there a lot of times, and the light will never change unless the car pulls up.
Okay, so how do I fix that?
Well, there's kind of an easy solution. High-powered neodymium magnets.
What kind of magnets?
High-powered neodymium magnets will send off enough of a magnetic force that will confuse this inductive loop into thinking that there's a large piece of metal there, like a large car.
Aren't there some dangers with tying really strong magnets to your bike?
No, there's really no dangers. You don't want to ride behind like a wedding vehicle that's got the cans dragging behind it. You'll end up going to the honeymoon, I guess.
Well, thanks for the tip, Kip.
Okay, great. Well, I'm curious to find out how everything works out.
So we found one of these under-the-road sensor things at a traffic light, and we're going to try and make a difference to the turning time of the traffic light using a magnet.
and I couldn't find one of the fancy neodymium magnets, whatever he was talking about. So I just bought a large horseshoe magnet with what claims to, it claims to have a 15-pound pulling power, and I have taped it to the bottom of Nora's bicycle. With the magnet on, we're now going to go and sit in front of the traffic light, and Nora's going to count.
Okay. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000.
Hello, who are you?
I'm Raj Bisessa, City of Toronto Traffic Signals.
Raj has just turned up randomly from the City of Toronto. Do you think this is a good strategy for bicyclists to use to attach magnets to their bicycles?
Not really, because on its own, if the loops are properly tuned, it should be able to detect the bicycle.
Oh, but we've heard they aren't.
The older ones, basically, when they were set up, the loops were not, the sensitivity of the loops were not set up to detect bicycles. But now, with the new signals, we have been trying to adjust them to detect bicycles.
That's great to hear, isn't it, Nora?
It's fabulous. Thanks, Raj.
Okay, goodbye.
That's fantastic that they're doing that.
Yeah, I think I'm still a fan of attaching a magnet to the bottom of your bike. That seems like the best plan.
Okay, I'm not sure we can officially recommend it. It does sound like a recipe for an accidental bumper shining, but thanks for investigating this, Tom. On behalf of the commuting community, I thank you.
Thanks, Nora.
Okay, let's time this thing. 1-1000, 2-1000. I've got the magnet over the little sensor. 3-1000, 4-1000, 5-1000.
What you can see emerging in the trends we talked about today is that idea of taking back the physical. Instead of us being chained to the computer becomes everywhere around us. Instead of submitting to the mindless tyranny of the traffic light, it responds to the kind of vehicle we're using. And instead of just accepting goods as they come to us off the shelf, we're taking an active role in creating them ourselves. That's it for Spark. The show was made by Tom Howell, Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, and me, Nora Young, and
Matthew Seiler,
Sherry Huss,
Andrew Keane, and also Rahaf Harfouche,
Greg Bodner, Louis Escobar, Catherine Rolfson.
I'm Raj Bisessa, City of Toronto Traffic Signals.
Spark is made with Creative Commons music, and you can find the artists at the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. I'm Nora Young. I hope you'll join us next time.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.